from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Hurricane Sandy looked bad coming in, blotting out half the Atlantic, it seemed, with that giant span. And it had so many elements: wind, rain, snow, full moon, storm surge, the super storm, with a serious death toll and damage that could top last year's Hurricane Irene at $16 billion. Now, the aftermath. This hour on Point, Superstorm Sandy, what she wrought and what we've learned. You can join the conversation. Did you get pummeled? Could you believe the size of that storm coming in? What are you thinking as we survey the damage? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going to look at weather in this hour, climate, the energy grid, transportation vulnerabilities, all that and more. Here, the sound of the bullseye. New York City, Lower Manhattan resident Josh Clarsfield said that heavy wind sent debris flying into a woman on the street.
I was on Canal Street, and a piece of scaffolding, like probably about 20 feet long, metal still in between the posts, just picked up speed as it went along, and a woman was getting out of a car, surprisingly. Like, she didn't see it coming, and it just tagged her.
Tagged her, lucky her, I guess. Mayor Bloomberg on water coming all through Lower Manhattan.
We have seen record surge levels. We're seeing an extraordinary amount of water throughout Lower Manhattan. There are trees down throughout the city.
And this morning on New York One News, MTA, the subway chairman Joseph Lota spoke about the extent of the damage to the city's transit system.
We're assessing the extent of the damage this morning. We started last night. We're beginning the process of recovery. I think New Yorkers should understand what happened here. As I said, this act of nature was by far the most devastating thing that we've ever experienced.
Seven tunnels down and subways flooded. Joining us from New York City, just about the bullseye of Hurricane Sandy, it turns out, is James Barron, reporter for the New York Times. James, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom. Good to be here.
So is New York feeling like it got battered, like it could have been worse, like it's never seen this before? It's hard for us to kind of get our hands around just how bad this is.
And it's hard for us, too, I think. I'm in the category right now of we've never seen anything like this. And in a way, Tropical Storm Irene a year ago, we thought that was going to be a dress rehearsal for this. And maybe it was, but this seems to be so much worse because it was more powerful. It hit closer. In Staten Island this morning, there was a ship that just got propelled up onto the shore, a 700-ton ship.
Wow.
Apparently. It reminds you of the power of nature. It reminds you, in a way, of why New York was put here, because this is a coastal place. This is the place in the days of ships that you could get to. But we all know, you know, they had horrible storms in the days when ships were teeny compared to what they are now.
And here we are, 13,000 airline flights canceled up and down the East Coast. I mean, even the Erie Canal was closed.
That's
right. 13-foot surge of seawater. That's 3 feet above the previous record into New York City, inundating tunnels and subways and all the rest. What about the dig out from that? How serious is the damage to the subway system?
I believe the subway officials have said it's worse than the worst case scenario. I've seen pictures of debris that's up as high as the platform you stand on. You know, the trains come along and the wheels are down below the platform, a 4 or 5 foot gap down there that they don't want you to fall in. Well, there have been pictures where there was water half that high, and now there's just the torrent of debris that goes through in the water, and the water runs out, and there's all this garbage there.
And you've got salt water then rushing through the subway. I don't know what that does to switching systems, electronics.
That was the big worry, Tom, that salt is corrosive. That much salt would be very corrosive to the signals and to the track, the undercarriage, and the track itself. And that's why, apparently, for only the second time in the history of the subway system, they closed it down and tried to get the trains to higher ground. The first time was last year during Irene.
First time last year, only the second time in history right here. I mean, these things stack up. Any idea how many days before those subways are all up and running again?
No. They said on Sunday they thought they'd be back and running within 12 hours after it was over. Well, it's not over yet. And if it's worse than the worst-case scenario, it's going to take time. They may get little bits and pieces back in Manhattan if they can clean it up, but I think the cleanup's going to be much more demanding, much more extensive, a lot more stuff is going to have to be carted out before we can go back down under and before the system will be going again.
Now, you've been watching that huge construction crane, some 80 stories above West 57th Street, this $1.5 billion luxury high-rise there, just dangling in this storm. What's the status of that now, James?
It's still dangling. I don't know yet. I don't think anyone knows yet when they'll be able to remove it safely, dismantle it, get it down safely. The wind is still blowing hard. There's sheets of rain still. It's lighter than it was for some of the day on Monday, but the storm, the trailing edge of the storm is still very much going through here. And I think until the wind dies down and they're able to do it without danger to the people who'd go up there, however they remove cranes. I've covered crane collapses before on sunny days here, That was easy compared to this. They wouldn't have to wait like this.
And what about Wall Street, James? It's closed again today. And you know what? And this storm surge, 13 feet, 3 feet above anything you've seen before. We've seen the water running through lower Manhattan. Mayor Bloomberg talking about that. And our minds automatically go back to, Hollywood has thought about this for a long time. And Al Gore, back in his film An Inconvenient Truth, he showed, this would be Manhattan, with this much sea rise. What about New York's viability here? I mean, how often can you have this kind of flooding and look at lower Manhattan and say, that's fine, or are you going to build bigger dikes around it? What happens here?
Well, I think that's the question going forward. And obviously, at this point, I don't have an answer, and I think it's too soon to say what the answer, maybe even what all the questions are. Those are certainly some of them. Again, we know this is an island, and we know that it's susceptible to the once-in-a-generation event. A lot of us thought that was last year, and now we've seen it's worse this time. This time we beat 1960, so twice in my lifetime, I'm giving away my age here a little bit, we've had extremely high flooding down at the Battery. I don't know what you can really do about that, and that's just the Battery. If you go out on Long Island, there are plenty of places that are underwater now, a place called Bayshore. Well, look at those two words in the name right there, bay and a shore.
Yeah.
There is flooding there. It's now down to about chest high from what I can see on the television video. But there's no way you could build a seawall there that's going to protect against something like this.
It's going to be really interesting to listen as, James, you and other New Yorkers absorb in days to come the meaning of Irene and now Sandy, whether we're on some kind of escalator here of storms or this is just a season. James Barron with the New York Times in New York City. Good luck to you all there, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks so much, Tom.
James Barron. This morning on NBC's Today Show, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie said the aftermath of the storm is a major disaster. 2.5 million people without power just across his state. Extensive flooding.
We have a battered New Jersey shore that I hope to tour a little bit later on today, but I think the losses are going to be almost incalculable.
Incalculable, says Chris Christie. Well, we'll look at that. People are talking about maybe topping the $16 billion in damages of Hurricane Irene. Of course, we've had bigger. Hurricane Katrina, $100 billion plus. Frank Marks joins us right now from Miami, Florida. He's director of the Hurricane Research Division at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He was co-lead for NOAA's Hurricane Irene Service Assessment. He flew into the eye of Hurricane Sandy on Sunday morning. Frank Marks, thank you very much for being with us from Miami.
Thank you, Tom. Pleasure to be here.
So we all watched this. I mean, the satellite images are out there. We all watch things coming. Now, it looked so gigantic. The full extent of the damage is really not yet compiled. But what's your sense? Could it have been worse given how massive this was? Or are we still learning?
I think this is probably unprecedented. This is probably the strongest storm I think that we could have experienced in this situation at this time of year. Storms, as they move northward, do get larger. Irene did the same thing. So what surprised us, I think, was how it maintained its hurricane strength in the core almost all the way to the coastline. I think that was a bit of a surprise. For those of us flying, we kept thinking as it came out of the Bahamas, we were flying seven straight back-to-back 12-hour missions, starting as it came off Cuba to collect data for the forecasts.
Yeah.
And we were surprised that it actually reinvigorated itself despite interactions with the mid-latitude cyclone that was moving in from the Great Lakes area.
As you look at this superstorm, this monster, are you and other hurricane experts thinking to yourself, this is some kind of new creature here? Or, you know, we got to keep a handle on things here. This is a gigantic storm, but we've seen gigantic storms before. How are you looking at it?
Well, you know, we can go back to 1954, and Hurricane Hazel hit almost the same area around the same time of year and was a major disaster that generated the National Hurricane Research Project that my organization is the successor of. And then we had the Grace in 1991, what so-called the perfect storm at the time that generated the movie and the book.
Mm-hmm.
That was a similar type event. At this time of year, these type of events can occur. Now, this one was stronger than normal or stronger than the past. And we do know that the globe is warming and there are changes in the extreme events that we're seeing as climate is changing. So I would say that, expected, it is not totally out of the question that we would have storms like this.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about Superstorm Sandy and what she wrought, what we've learned as we watch that big, big storm come ashore. Frank Marks is with us from Miami, Florida. This one did not whack Florida, as so many have. This one coming north and in a big, big way. He's with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. On Sunday, he flew into the eye of Hurricane Sandy, monitoring it as it came north. We're at 800-423-8255. So, Frank, did this perfect storm convergence happen in the end? Is that what we saw or not? The cold front, you know, from the west and this from the Atlantic, did it converge in a way that people feared?
Well, actually, I think the convergence is occurring right now.
Okay.
It was a hurricane almost all the way up right to the shore of New Jersey. So this was becoming what it is now. I think we haven't seen the main impacts of this. We're going to see this very cold air outbreak over the next few days and then this weekend into New England and New York area. It's just going to exacerbate the pain they're under right now as we get the cold air coming in.
What do you expect to see there? That the main impact is still to come after all this flooding, what would that be? What would the main impact be?
Well, it'll be different. Remember, these people mm-hmm. have no power, and now it's going to get real cold. So you're going to have different kinds of situations. You have people in shelters. This event is still unfolding. I wouldn't, you know, say we dodged any bullets, not that we have. I think, you know, one mm-hmm. of the problems that we see as meteorologists while we study these storms is, you know, our learning curve on improving our ability to predict these events is being overtaken by man's encroachment on nature, putting ourselves in a more vulnerable and at more risk from these events. You know, New York City, we talk about Hazel in 54. The population of the U.S. has probably gone up by about 30% since 1954. We've built all these infrastructures along the coasts that are impacted by these events.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have airfields. We're so much more dependent on things. And these events are much more impactful to our living.
Because our human structure of life is more and more elaborate, more and more kind of in the face of nature. That the wingspan of this, or I'm not sure what the proper word is, but it was so wide. And that got a lot of comment on air from all the TV commentators and radio as this thing came in. What about that? Is that a big deal to a hurricane specialist like yourself that its mass over the Atlantic was so big? And what might have made it so enormous?
Well, I think there's a perception by the public that the hurricane is a lot smaller than it really is. When you look at the satellite imagery, looking at a storm as it moves across the ocean, you see this nice cloud field, a nice spiral pattern, and you don't think about its breadth. Typically, the breadth is 300 to 500 miles. In this case, we were about 1,000 as it moved north.
Yeah.
So These storms are big and much bigger than people perceive. Now, typically in the hurricane, most of the damage is in the core, in the inner 100 nautical miles.
Mm-hmm.
In this case, the wind field expanded as it went north, as it interacted with the other weather systems.
What made it? So why did it do that? Why so big? I mean, 1,000 is much bigger than 500. So why?
Well, the wind field is driven by the pressure gradient, and we had a large high pressure system to the north over New England as it moved north. That tightened the pressure gradient out to very far distances. We had a system, a high pressure in a cold front moving from the west. That also increased the pressure gradient, which drove the wind field over such a large area. So it's the interaction with these mid-latitude systems at this late time of year. A very potent tropical core that combined to make this such a devastating event.
We're going to look at transportation issues, energy issues, and more in just a moment. Bennett's calling from Fairfield, Vermont. Bennett, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
Okay. What do you think?
I think I'd like to counter some of the things that your guest is saying. First off, global warming, it's been a lot warmer in the past, and this is just another storm. What the gentleman fails to mention is that there hasn't been any significant global warming in the last 16 years. So to attribute a single event to warming of the Earth is kind of silly. I mean, while we're getting a little warmer here, they're freezing over in Europe.
Hey, Bennett, let me ask you, he's director of hurricane research at NOAA. What's your expertise, Bennett?
Well, I've done a lot of research on it, just looking at what the claims are and why the claims are made and how the data is being manipulated.
But I'm just curious. I mean, I take your point, and many people make it, but here's a guy who's the director of research. Why do you feel so ready to, you know, sort of flick his considered opinion aside?
Well, I understand. I mean, he has to maintain his position in the community of scientists, and if he goes against the status quo and the approved paradigm, he doesn't get his research grants.
Let us look at it. Frank, what do you say to Bennett? He's pretty tough on you and the perspective. Now, he may be exaggerating what you're saying, but what are you thinking as you hear that, Frank?
I agree with Bennett. I would not attribute any one event to global warming at all. What I was saying is that as the globe warms, which there is no doubt that the globe is warming, you just have to look at the sea surface temperature changes. And in actuality, the biggest impacts are in the Arctic, not in the tropics. The tropics haven't changed very much.
Mm-hmm.
These events occur all the time. My feeling is I agree with Bennett. I don't really want to get into the global warming argument. I don't think that that's a fruitful argument. My job is to improve the hurricane forecasts. And I would argue that no matter which scenario you believe, whether the globe is warming or not, the tropical cyclones are going to occur and they're going to impact man.
But is it about belief or is it about science?
Well, the science is there.
And the science says what?
The science says the globe has warmed, and it has steadily warmed since the mid-50s.
So how do you reconcile? I mean, there's Bennett, and he says, come on, give me a break. But on the other hand, online, we've got people writing. Here's Marin says, my question is, why do hardly any media link the frequency and severity of these storms to climate change? It's like we've got our heads in the sand, have resigned ourselves to live in denial. You know, just the polar opposite, if I can use that phrase, to Bennett's perspective on this. And here you are in the middle. How do you look at these perspectives?
Well, I probably am agnostic about those opinions. Like I said, Tom, my main goal is to improve the forecast. That's a 5-day to 6-day, maybe 7-day window that I'm interested in. So almost all of my division's research is on that. We're trying to collect observations, and we're working under what we call the Hurricane Forecast Improvement Project, which is a 10-year project that started in 2009 that we were going to cut the errors in track and intensity by 50% in 10 years. That's our goal. I'm not looking at the global warming issue at all.
But you're talking about seas warming. Does that change the storms that are produced?
No, not really. The storms that are produced are pretty much identical to what they were 50 years ago, but likely 100 years ago. The frequency has gone up a little bit, but we know that there's cycles in the North Atlantic that drive a lot of that periodicity. It doesn't have to deal with global warming at all. We're in a warm phase of those cycles, which usually has more tropical cyclones per year. And as Bennett pointed out, from year to year, that variability is very large. Last year, we had probably 12 storms. This year, we're up in the 16 range. 2 years ago, we had about 10. So, I mean, the variability is a lot. So I would not want to be considered advocating that we're going to have more storms because of the change. We have more extremes, though, I would argue.
Boy, it can be driven sort of mad by all these perspectives on what's going on and trying to
That's why I try and keep my focus very tight, Tom, on the five-day forecast.
Yes, and yet, you know, citizens of the planet want to sit back and have some bigger sense of what's going on, too. Frank Marks, stand by there in Miami. I want to bring into our conversation Noel Perry. He's a principal at Transport Fundamentals, one of the country's top transportation economists. Noel Perry, thanks very much for joining us. Welcome back to On Point.
Hello, Tom.
How do you see the impact of this storm in terms of its disruption of transportation right across the board, its economic impact, and how's it rate?
Well, there's two ways to look at it. Obviously, from what we've heard everywhere, this is a very, very big thing, and that counts in transportation. I'd divide the impact up into two pieces. First off, there's the destruction part. What's happening in the subways in New York and what's happening along the coast, mm-hmm. principally. Mm-hmm. And that, for transportation, means a lot of work putting it back together. The piece that most people don't think about is what I would call friction. We've had disruption now for 1,000 miles, and under that 1,000-mile umbrella is about 700,000 loads a day.
This is truckloads, train loads?
All.
Okay. Loads of cargo
loads
stuff.
Loads of cargo and you know, millions of people in cars. And of course, we've heard 13,000 flights canceled.
And how many loads a day did you say?
Somewhere north of 700,000.
700,000. So day by day, those are kind of stacking up and stranded
well,
up.
Yes. And at best, they are moving at, let's say, 50% of their normal velocity.
What does that mean for the East Coast economy, for this very, very large region, from all the way down to the Carolinas to up, well, nearly Maine?
Well, in the short term, it'll mean shortages. If you're truck dependent, shortages 2 or 3 days. If you're rail dependent, probably a week or more. In the long run, it means a plus for the economy of the region, because it turns out that when we have these big disasters, the cleanup and repair efforts tend to generate a plus for the economy. So, ironically, from an economic standpoint, this is probably a good thing for the Northeast.
That over time, there'll be more inputs coming in, more activity
yes.
to fix up what's destroyed. How do you look at our transportation system overall when we see this kind of storm? You know, is it up to snuff? Could we make it less vulnerable? Would that be economic to do?
Well,
is it going to be required?
Our transportation system is a very, very good one. But it operates in a very tight system of trade-offs, and the trade-offs are: if you want it to be cheap, you have to use the capacity very efficiently. And one of the things that's happened very clearly over the past 20 years mm-hmm. is we've taken capacity out of the system.
How?
Well, by providing fewer things. For instance, if you ride in an airplane now, mm-hmm. it's almost always full. Used to be it
was. Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah.
And so what happens is when you have one of these situations where the throughput of the system falls because of the weather, there isn't the extra capacity that we used to have to get people home.
We can see that. Listen, in the transportation world, Noel, are people sitting thinking we're on some kind of extreme event escalator? It's getting worse. We've got to factor this in new ways when it comes to infrastructure, equipment, insurance, and the rest, or it's just life as usual, up and down, on we go?
Clearly, we're getting better with practice. However, if you think about the private sector is focused on next year. They seldom think 30 years out. The public sector is thinking about deficits, And so there is not a lot of capacity right now to fundamentally improve the system. Now, I would also say, by the way, that with the exception of those places like Lower Manhattan and the coast, mm-hmm. and maybe where there's some flooding, we will not see the same kind of fundamental long-term destruction that we had down in the Gulf Coast.
Katrina.
Yeah, this storm is about friction,
mm-hmm.
and so as consumers, we're going to pay 5 or 10% more for the next 2 or 3 weeks to recover. That doesn't seem like much, but when you multiply that by the 700,000 loads a day that are affected, it turns out to be probably the biggest storm we've ever had.
Noel Perry with Transport Fundamentals with us from Mannheim, Pennsylvania today. Thank you so much, Noel. Always good to hear from you.
Yes.
Sam Brothwell joins us right now from New Jersey, Senior Utilities Analyst for Bloomberg Industries. Sam Brothwell, thanks for joining us.
Hi, Tom. Glad to be here.
7.5 million or something like that people without power. Is our grid up to this kind of storm, or is that clear evidence that it's not, Sam?
Well, I don't think any grid can stand up to what we've seen here, just considering particularly the flooding. Whether you put equipment underground or it's on the ground, if it's underwater, it's underwater and it can't work.
So we've got a superstorm of a size that maybe nobody's ever seen here. We're talking about historic impact on the New York subway system. We've seen, you know, blowing up in Manhattan. I don't know what that was. The transformer, I guess. I mean, do we just have to think about a future where more and more millions of people are periodically stripped of power and that's just the way it goes?
No, not necessarily. I think in the aftermath of this, we'll probably start taking a hard look at what can be done to bring technology to bear on the system. What we have in the U.S. is kind of a radial system that evolved during the 20th century where power is largely generated at central plants, sent out over high voltage transmission lines, and distributed to end users. It is very robust. It's worked very well. But in this type of a situation where you have a massive storm like this, it's going to get knocked down, and it's going to take time to bring it back up. I think we can start employing smart grid technology, perhaps begin using more distributed generation, smaller scale combined heat and power to make the system more robust, but make no mistake, this can't happen overnight, and it will cost money.
Well, if you build a smart grid, which would be great in many ways, but very expensive, of course, you're still facing, I guess, just trees on power lines, simple old-fashioned physics and gravity and wind.
Absolutely. There's nothing that can be done to harden against that. I think what makes our region a little different is we're not used to this kind of weather. Utilities in Florida and the Southeast have had to deal with this and probably have beefed up their systems a little bit more than here in the Northeast. I'm not criticizing the utilities. It's just that we have not been accustomed to it. We may need to start looking at some of the practices that the utilities that are more accustomed to hurricanes employ.
Sam Brothwell, Senior Utilities Analyst for Bloomberg Industries, joining us from Locust, New Jersey. Sam, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at storms and impacts on the day after Sandy's landfall. Frank Marks is with us from Miami, Florida, director of the Hurricane Research Division at NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. He was actually flying in the eye of Hurricane Sandy just on Sunday morning. He's on solid ground now and talking with us. Frank, we got a lot of callers. Nathan in New Orleans. Thanks for calling, Nathan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hey, it just seems to me that as of late, especially since the two severe storms that we've had thus far this year seem to be Category 1, that we've really got to the point where we're, I guess, underestimating the overall devastation that can follow a path like this. And I'm, you know, living here in Southeast Louisiana, I've seen the way that the government is able to kind of deal with the overall disaster response. But I was wondering, in an area, especially like New York or I guess the general East Coast, where you have such a large concentration of a population, I guess there's been a lack of the reporting on this. Was there much preparation done for homeless folks in New York during the storm?
Well, I know a lot of people are asking about that online as well, because we heard about 300,000 plus who were asked to evacuate in advance of this. But I think the difference from Katrina, New Orleans, is that apart from the Rockaway community, where, 80 houses or something were burning the last I heard, these were not evacuations from houses that were swept away or destroyed or made uninhabitable. Presumably, people will be coming back, though. Think about basement apartments in lower Manhattan. It's going to take a while to muck those out and get into them. But you're quite right in pointing out that the aftermath impacts can be long for a lot of individuals, though maybe not the same as in Katrina's case. I appreciate your call, Nathan. Let me get another here. Robin in Bodenham, Maine. Robin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I have two questions, actually. One, I was told something about how the storm was sort of eating up the Gulf Stream, and I know that there's something about how hurricanes will absorb a lot of the warm temperature from the water, and I'm curious what type of effects that will have on the weather into the winter season here and then across the water. So mm-hmm. I know the Gulf Stream usually affects weather. And then the other one is that it didn't sound like the last question was totally responded to, because it was about homeless people, not people necessarily who are out of their homes.
Well, I mean, the truth of the matter is that I don't have a New Yorker on here to tell us right now. Just trying to share with Nathan there, evacuation versus home destruction. And in all candor, I guess you're right, Robin. We're going to have to wait and see what the news that comes out of New York in terms of how deep that destruction is. So with apologies, I just don't have a straight-up answer for that as we speak right here. But I think we can go to your Gulf Stream question. And, Frank, this eating up the Gulf Stream, we're changing it, its temperature, potential weather changes on the other side of a superstorm like Sandy?
Well, in actuality, the ocean is the source of the energy. But what drives that exchange is the air temperature and the air humidity. And what happened in the case of Sandy, we had very dry air surrounding the system and encroaching into the system, and it drove a lot of evaporation, which generated all the rainfall. The Gulf Stream itself probably was cooled by the passage of the storm. The wind over the water tends to cool the ocean due to both the evaporation and the mixing of cooler water from below. Now, Sandy's life was mainly not over the Gulf Stream. It was out to the east of the Gulf Stream. It only briefly passed through the Gulf Stream just east of North Carolina. When we were flying out there, we put down ocean probes into the ocean so we can measure the sea surface temperature and the upper level thermal structure as well as the atmospheric. And what we were seeing was relatively cool ocean temperatures. Such a large storm, it would cool a large area by mixing up. The wind kind of acts like a stirrer. It moves the warmer water at the surface away from the center, which causes upwelling.
How long lasting is the impact then, Frank? Could it change this winter's weather?
It'll last for probably into the winter. At this time of year, when we have a mixing event like this, it has a much longer signal in the ocean through the winter than we would have expected if it had occurred, say, in August.
Would that mean a warmer winter in North America, a cooler winter, or no idea?
Well, the Gulf Stream will replace the warm water rather rapidly. That's why it's mm-hmm. called the Gulf Stream. Mm-hmm. It comes out of the Straits of Florida and moves up the East Coast. So there's, you know, coming warm water coming out of the Caribbean is pretty continuous. So the Gulf Stream will probably not change much. The area south and east of the Gulf Stream, east of between Bermuda and the East Coast, will be cooler likely. There are a number of studies that have suggested that a hurricane can adjust the circumpolar water transfer from the warm waters of the Caribbean into the North Atlantic. I think this will be an excellent case to look at that. But I think right now it's too hard to tell. I know that all past studies have suggested late storms have more impact on the ocean.
Hey, when you're flying in the eye, as you were with Sandy on Sunday, you said you put instruments down to measure in the ocean. What are you dropping thermometers or something from the airplane, or how's that work?
Well, the NOAA aircraft that we fly in are flying laboratories. We have three radar systems on board. We have all sorts of remote sensors, and we have the ability to drop on parachutes sounding instruments that provide temperature and humidity and pressure and wind as they fall. And then also at the same time, a probe that we put out together with it that goes straight to the ocean surface and then deploys a drogue that goes down to about 900 meters into the ocean.
Wow, we get a very, very explicit picture there of measuring going on in the eye of the storm. Rod in Bloomfield, Connecticut. Thanks for calling, Rod. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you doing, sir?
Well, what do you see?
Well, I tell you, we're doing a recon right now on some power lines outside of Bloomfield here. Not a little damage, very little, if any, problems at all, but the reason I called, and I'm like I said, I've been in this business for 30 years.
What's the business, Rod? Repairing power lines or what?
Yes, sir. Power line repair. I'm a power lineman.
Got it.
And like you say, I understand that there are very many different issues that you face when you build a power line.
Mm-hmm.
And the right of ways that we build, that we spread and clear, are critical not only to the power line, but also trying to mitigate the amount of damage we do to the environment.
Mm-hmm.
The unfortunate deal, though, that we face here, wherever we build both transmission or distribution lines, is maintaining a specific distance for tree line to the power line.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, people love their trees. I myself have trees in my yard that I would never dream of cutting back or cutting down.
Yeah, yeah.
But unfortunately, there are situations where distribution lines, transmission lines, less than 3 to 5 feet from any trees that tower over them.
So what's your bottom line there, Rod? If we're going to have more extreme events, you're the power line guy. Are you saying we're going to have fewer trees to...
Well, what we're going to have to do is establish cutback distances from these distribution lines. Right-of-way clearance so that if a tree does fall, it's not going into the line.
Well, I mean, everybody knows that, but nobody, as you say, nobody really wants it. And if we're in a period where we're going to have more of this with huge power outages here, I don't know. Maybe it comes back around to people thinking that way. I mean, you're on the front lines, so you see it, Rod. But point taken. If you're going to have a lot of big storms, how are you going to have big trees all around those lines and not have the kind of power outages that we're looking at? I want to shift gears a little bit, if I may. And welcome into our conversation right now from Arlington, Massachusetts, Marla Markham. She's Director of Programs for the Better Future Project. It's a grassroots group looking at climate change. They've actually been holding a vigil this past week saying they want more conversation about climate change in this campaign season, and they haven't been getting it. Marla Markham, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks, Tom.
What's your complaint?
Realize that we're not going to be able to address the crisis and the fact that...
Marla, you're breaking up entirely on us, and I'm sorry we can't get you there. But hey, if you've got a better phone line, try and get to us, and we'll get you back on. Ryan in New Orleans, thank you for calling, Ryan. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
What I wanted to communicate to you guys, I understand that this is kind of a analysis program, but what I wanted to strongly encourage and kind of get out to the public up mm-hmm. there is that having gone through Katrina, this is a time when you really need to help your neighbor. It's going to get cold. All those trees that are on the ground, cut them up, make firewood for elderly people that are not able to do that, because this is a long process and it's not easy. You have the benefit of having being a huge population center with resources, so the government is there. And the main thing I wanted to warn people against is that when the insurance companies come to fix the damage or to assess the damage, look out, because they are terrible. We had 6 feet of water in our house after Katrina, and they paid for the awning that got ripped up in the back of our house.
Wow.
And we had to bring them to court to do that. So all the lawyers up in the Northeast, get ready, because insurance companies are horrendous.
Ryan, that's a good forewarning. You know, be ready with your documentation, save your photographs, have just as good a record of the damage as you can nail down when it comes time for that wrangling. And quite right, throughout, help your neighbor. Appreciate your call from New Orleans, Ryan. I think we've got Marla back on the line. Marla, are you there?
Yes. Is this better?
It's better. We lost you entirely. What's your message?
So we understand that that climate change really is going to affect storms like this. We're going to see them perhaps more often, but certainly with sea level rise, we're going to have a lot. The storm surge is going to be a lot bigger problem for people. That's an economic issue. And we really decided we need to do something big to try to get the attention of our elected leaders and those who are seeking office this season, because they're not talking about climate change. So we've been holding a vigil to break the climate silence on Government Center for a week.
This is in the City Hall Plaza in Boston. So do you think you're succeeding? I mean, we have not heard much about this, barely a peep in the presidential debates about climate.
Yeah, it was the first time in 24 years, actually, that climate change didn't come up in a presidential debate. And we've been focusing, though, here on the Brown-Warren Senate debate, because we know that that a lot rides on this election and that the whole country is watching, and neither of these candidates actually use the word climate. So we're calling on our Massachusetts leaders to really deal with the issue, to tell us what they believe about climate change.
Yeah, so there's a big race, Scott Brown and Elizabeth Warren, but of course that debate itself now called off because of the hurricane. I mean, I wonder, you know, you're out there raising your voices as citizens, saying get this in the debate, and then the hurricane itself comes and kind of slams things down. It's one headwind on top of another, Marla.
Yeah, the irony wasn't lost on us, and so we're hoping that people can join us to call for people to raise their voices and say we need to deal with this crisis before it gets out of hand.
Where it stands now may already be out of hand, given some sort of a historic first we've seen with Sandy. Marla Markham, thank you for joining us, and good luck with your work at the Better Future Project. Let's get a caller from New York City, Rodrigo. Hi, Rodrigo, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom, how are you?
Well, what have you seen, Rodrigo?
Well, I tell you, I live in First Street and 74, and here we were clear, right?
Yeah.
So I decided to see if I could help. I went to the closest shelter in Hunter College, and it's surprising. It's tough. The picture there, you know. Today I came back nice and dry at my home. There's more than 250 people there. They can't come back.
You
they
saw
don't know two, what, about the apartments.
Yeah, 250 people in one shelter in New York City you saw? That's pretty rough.
Yeah, it was. Yes, I spent there from yesterday, like 5 until just now.
Yeah, so it's real. People out of their apartments, and a lot of water in lower Manhattan, and we don't know exactly when they'll get back in. Rodrigo, you remind us that, you know, the impacts of these things, they can happen in 24 hours, but they can linger, the impact, for a long, long time. I appreciate your call, Rodrigo, and good luck there in Manhattan, in New York City. See if I can get another from up the coast a little bit in Westbrook, Connecticut. Colin's calling. Colin, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I am calling. There's a lot of points that I want to make, but I'll focus on one, is the fact that we really should not be putting infrastructure on the shore. There's no point in building houses, hotels, casinos, whatever the case may be, where they're going to be affected more and more by the climate crisis. We really need to start incentivizing people to move away from the shore, and that includes both businesses and households. And I'm saying this as a person who lives not on the shore, but on a town on the shore in Connecticut, that it's just asinine that we're putting these people, or people are putting themselves in harm's way, and then as taxpayers, we go and we have to spend all the money try to, you know, put up the seawalls, to put up, you know, any kind of...
Colin, I know what you mean, and, you may be right that it's asinine if we have more extreme weather events, but you also know, living in a coastal town, how rabidly people want to be there. I mean, what do you think it would take to turn people away from building on the shore?
Quite frankly, and I'm saying this as a person, I'm actually running for Congress here in Connecticut, and I think that we really need government intervention, preventing, you know, either buying property that's on the sale to take it off the market, and then, you know, I guess dismantling those things, but then also, again, creating incentives for towns and local municipalities to to prevent, you know, through local zoning laws, from any more development that's already there.
Wow, tough challenge. What do you think? I don't know what party you're in, but when Mitt Romney said in the Republican debate June of last year, you know, John King, CNN, asked him if they should reduce funding to FEMA in effect, and he said absolutely. How does that sound on the day after Sandy to you, Colin?
Well, I mean, it sounded the day before and the day after. It's asinine. I mean, FEMA is one of the parts of the government that we absolutely need, because these disasters, because of the climate crisis, are going to be happening more and more, and if not more and more, then definitely with more intensity. You know, right here in Connecticut, and in the past year, you know, Hurricane Irene last year, then a freak October snowstorm that crippled the state, now Hurricane Sandy, like all of these disasters happening across the country with greater frequency and greater intensity, FEMA is going to be the thing, one of the agencies that we rely on with more and more.
There's the word from the shore in Connecticut, as the huge region of the East Coast and inland looks around, slaps its forehead, and looks to dig out from the damage of Superstorm Sandy. Frank Marks with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Miami, Florida. Frank, thanks so much for your insights and your time today. Thank you for joining us, sir.
Thank you, Tom. And as the only word I would say is, hurricanes are more than just the center. You got impacts from rain and wind, and
we
that's
see
what
it.
People
we're living it. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.